Good morning. We are thrilled you're here, and you're all really remarkable. And we are going to have an extraordinary experience this morning. The class, we are very grateful that we have three people who have already addressed us in this great Learning for Life experience at Northwestern. Northwestern is known for many things, and I might add that our Kellogg world was one of the great examples. That's where this began 41 years ago, this course. And I would say that today you have distinguished professors, Professor Sawney, who has spoken to us, when was that? Maybe 15 years ago? And he is dazzling. Anyone who's gone through Kellogg felt that it was a privilege to have him as a professor. We also have Professor Zettelmeyer, who is going to speak to us, who has also spoken to us and before. And to lead our course, you know Rachel's out of town, and she's with the provost, working as one of the five provost scholars, doing some other work. We have so much fun having Paul Christensen here, who was a coordinator for 1 year, and then by popular demand, mine, he came back a second year when we were doing international business. So thank you. Please remember our dinner in 2 weeks, and we're thrilled you're here. Thank you.
Thank you, Shirley. Well, thank you, Shirley, and good morning, everyone. It's great to be here and see so many familiar faces. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Paul Christensen. I'm a clinical professor of finance at Kellogg, and as of 2 weeks ago, I'm now the associate dean for Kellogg's executive education programs, which are all of the programs we teach, non-degree granting. Thank you. So I'm also delighted to be your substitute teacher here today, and I expect everybody to be on their best behavior. I'm going to have to report this back to Rachel. It was a real honor for me to serve as the coordinator for 2 years, I think, several years back on topics of international business. But I'm delighted to be here today to introduce two of my colleagues that I work with very closely at Kellogg. And they're going to be discussing media and technology and how the concepts of, or the technologies and practices are disrupting traditional business models. Our first speaker today is Professor Mohan Sawney. He's the McCormick Chair of Technology and the Director of the Center for Research in Technology and Innovation at Kellogg. Professor Sawney is a globally recognized scholar, teacher, consultant, speaker, on business innovation, technology marketing, and new media. A topic, obviously, that's close to you guys this year with your sessions. Over his distinguished career, he's authored 6 different books on a variety of topics. He's published dozens of articles, both in the scholarly literature, as well as the popular business periodicals. I think he's won or been nominated for every single top teaching award there is at Kellogg, as you'll see. And he advises some of the world's largest companies on the kinds of issues that he's going to talk to us about today, including GE and Cisco. In fact, he was sitting right next door to me all day yesterday working with Microsoft on a new online course offering that he's developing. Professor Sawney earned his MBA from the Indian Institute of Management, Calcutta, and holds a PhD in marketing from Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania. Please join me in welcoming Mohan to discuss his unique views.
Thank you, Paul. If you just kept going, you could have gone for an hour and I'd be done, you know, just. It's a pleasure to be with such a distinguished group this morning. It's really for us an honor to speak to you. Because from the vantage points that you sit, you have a very privileged view of what's going on in the world. And I'm going to share what I see in, I think the purpose of the theme that we were asked to look at was business transformation or transforming business. And if you look at the way business is being transformed today, perhaps the most important secular transformative force is technology. It is disrupting every industry. You name an industry and I'll tell you how it will be destroyed over the next 5 years, or transformed. I think destroyed is creative destruction. There are two ways to deal with a tsunami. You can surf it or you can get swallowed up by it. So we're going to talk about surfing. So you'll notice that what I want to talk about, and by the way, when we say technology is, I'm going to take a narrower interpretation of digital technology, right? So that's really the disruptive and transformative force we're going to talk about. And so as you see in the title, I have sort of two parts to it. The first part is, what are the forms of disruption that are taking place? And we'll do some pattern recognition here, which is you start to see patterns when you see, a company at a time. And so I'm going to share with you some archetypes of disruption. But if I left you there, it would not be very helpful, because I'm assuming that our interest of the majority of the people in the room, your interests are tied to incumbent firms more than startups. Am I correct? Right? So if the large corporations die, some of us are affected. So therefore, the second part of the discussion is very important, which is, what do we do about it? In fact, I believe that any presentation should have three parts: what, so what, and now what. Right? So we're going to get to the now what. Otherwise, all I can tell you is I can be Chicken Little and say the world is falling and then I can leave. But that's not very helpful. So that's the second part of what we'll talk about, is how do you deal with disruption by transforming business? And again, we're going to look at patterns. Transformation strategies, again, we'll organize them in terms of this descending order of intestinal fortitude. Right? So what I mean by that is that there are disruptive strategies to deal with disruption, and there are more incremental strategies. And it depends on the mandate that leadership has on their ability to push through the level of cultural change and people change that is required. So these strategies will vary based on how disruptive they in turn are, which, by the way, should be a function of how imminent your death is. So that's something we'll talk about. And so we'll begin with what do we mean by disruption? And I have a simple point of view on disruption, and that is, let's not look at supply side, let's look at what it does for customers. A disruption is meaningless unless a customer says, this is better. So a very simple way of defining disruption is that it is the application of digital technologies and networks, whether there are sensors, devices, networks, by the way, the digital technology can be organized roughly into the eyes and ears, which are the sensors, the rails, which are the networks, and then the devices that are at the other end. And on top of it sits algorithms. So that's sort of the whole ecosystem. Those are the sort of tools, but what we're doing to it is, at the end of the day, it has to create customer value. That's our metric. Disruption, very simply, is something that does 10x to a customer experience in some way. I took Uber to come here this morning because I didn't want to mess around with parking and I could get work done. I made some phone calls on the way. I would not have taken Uber, overtaken a taxi, unless that experience was better. So that's a simple way of thinking about it. We sometimes get caught up in the technology. It's not about that. It's really about, you know, what is it doing? And at the end of the day, some value metric needs to get affected. The customer value proposition needs to be affected in a fundamental way. And in a fundamental way, I'm not talking 10%, 20%. It's a 5x, 10x improvement in some figure of merit. That's what's disruption. Now, how we do it, we could disrupt the product. I mean, the product itself could get transformed. We'll talk about some examples of that. We could disrupt a channel, the way we reach customers using technologies and networks. You know, we've all bought from Amazon, and we know what that means, or mobile devices. We could disrupt business models, which is how you get paid. We could disrupt market efficiencies, create new ways of matching supply and demand. That's also possible. Or we could disrupt the user experience. And don't underestimate the simple disruption that can be caused by the user experience. I will not name the banks because some people might hear, you know, be associated with them. But I recently switched all my banking relationships from Bank X to Bank Y. And the reason I did that is because Bank X did not allow me on my app to move money between my business account and my personal account. It did not have a biometric login. It had, you know, I needed a token and to go on a website to log into my account. So I said, and it was very interesting that the banker, my private banker, said, "Don't you love us?" I said, "I absolutely love you." And I actually, they do a really nice job. But so I love you once in 6 months, but I need my app once in six times a day. So if it's a pain when I'm traveling internationally, I can't even, like, you know, log into my business account or move money back and forth, you know, love is oversold. So, right, it's overstated. So it's a very simple thing that, so today, you know, one simple question to ask is whatever organization you deal with, even as customers, or you may be involved with as decision makers, what is the device experience, mobile experience that you're providing to your customer? What does that interface look like? And a very simple sort of leading indicator of that is this is look at your share amongst older people and look at your share amongst millennials. If your share amongst millennials is lower, that's a leading indicator that something is lacking in your experience. Because my kids, who are my daughters at Northwestern, they don't go to banks. They want banking. They don't want banks, right? And, you know, more than half of millennials have no interest whatsoever in walking into a bank. So all love needs to be digital for them. So there are lots of ways in which digital technologies are affecting, you know, our industries. So this is a simple way of thinking about the customer value proposition. Six C's. These are the vectors along which disruption will hit. Right, it can hit along the vector of choice. You know, Amazon is able to provide us with hundreds of times the choice that a retail store is because they don't have physical inventory in every store. So that's one form factor. The other is cost. By creating market efficiencies, by eliminating middlemen, by just making, and one of the biggest developments of recent year is these marketplaces, or what we call shared asset and shared labor marketplaces, you know, Airbnb, Uber, and so on. And it's a simple thought that your car is being used 5% of the time. You know, your home has idle capacity that can be monetized. So the way we reduce cost is by improving asset utilization. Convenience. This again goes to what I was talking about with my bank, that, you know, can I get access 7x24? Can I do it on demand? Are your services available to me on my, you know, this is why now we don't move outside our house. We get somebody to come in and clean our house. We get somebody to come and deliver the food and deliver the groceries. And so, you know, there are people running around delivering stuff to us because it's convenient, right? Control. If you think about what you like about, you know, one of the things I like about the Uber experience is control. I have control over it, and I can drive it. I just came from Hong Kong and India. Both places, I used Uber, and I didn't have to worry about how many Hong Kong dollars or Indian rupees I had, what are the tipping convention of those countries, and when is this. And by the way, I was also in Germany 2 weeks ago, where they banned Uber, And I don't speak German. I didn't have enough euros. I don't know what the tipping convention is. I don't know how to call a cab. Right? And speak German while calling a cab. You know, Florian's okay, he's German. So please tell the Germans to unban Uber, you know.
We all speak English.
Yeah. And the websites are in German to call the cab. So anyway, so that's the aspect of control, that you feel that you're in control. Customization, personalization of the experience. And this is where you can use data as a competitive advantage to really create personal experiences, because in today's world, we know a lot more about customers. This is what, you know, Florian spends his life studying. The fact that, you know, if you think about a company like Intel, I spoke to them 10 years ago, I said, what do you know about your customers? They said two things: it has two legs and it owns a PC, yeah. Right? They have no data whatsoever on their customer. They put the microprocessor into the PC, and that PC is sold through Hewlett Packard, and somebody uses it, and it's gone. McDonald's, you know, you come in, you buy a burger, and you leave. They have no information on you. But today, if you're Microsoft, and all your software is going into the cloud, they are for the first time doing, you know, they now have telemetry. They can actually observe people using the product in real time and say, oh, nobody uses Access, or nobody uses this feature in Excel. You know, and literally you can, you know, there might be a time where you'll be able to pay by feature. So we're getting a lot more data, and that allows us to do immense level of customization. And then something that is totally unique to digital is community, the power of community. The fact that we have product reviews, and we can, I mean, if you think about the billion-dollar company Waze, what was Waze? It was social GPS. I love their tagline, outsmarting traffic together. And that is a unique phenomenon, that we are infusing products with community and crowdsourcing and the power of sort of collaborative effort. That has given us things like Linux, that has given us things like Waze, that has given us the product reviews in Amazon, and so on. So these are some of the, now, why is this important to think about? If you are an incumbent, you need to benchmark your customer value proposition on these six metrics, and then think about how much you suck against the best in class. So that's where the attack is coming, because that's the customer view of digital disruption. Okay? So let's take an example, a couple of examples. I have a simple formula here. Take any industry and put the word connected in front of it. It transforms, right? So fitness. Connected fitness is not the fitness that you know. This is a company, I was with them last year in Cesena, Italy. It's a company called Technogym. When the Italians make treadmills, they look like this and they cost $10,000 because it's a Lamborghini. It's a beautiful machine. But what is beautiful about this machine, and not just the design, is the fact that it's an Android device. And it talks to, so here's what happens. You step up to the machine, it talks to your band, and it downloads the data from there and says, I know you ran 5 miles yesterday, and so today's routine will be 3 miles, because I know you're trying to lose weight, and by the way, I have your nutrition data, and I have your EMR. So if I combine my health data with my medical information, with my fitness information, I can tailor a workout for you, which will basically say, okay, you're going to be running 5 miles today, but I saw you ate a donut yesterday, so that's another 2 miles for you. And by the way, I know you have a heart condition, so I'll keep it under 120 beats per minute. I'm tracking this thing. And by the way, do you want to repeat the run that you did yesterday when you were running outside? Because I tracked it on the band, and I can create in 3D the same route for you and run at the same speed. That is called the wellness cloud. So this is what they're able to enable by combining your apps with your devices, with your electronic, you know, medical record and health and nutrition information, and this becomes the idea of the quantified self. I am a bunch of numbers now, and I can quantify myself and so on. By the way, then you can also do gamification, where connect this machine to the other machine, saying that guy's running faster than you, and so on and so forth. You're going to have a leaderboard. So fitness gets transformed. And another thing I want you to continue to think about as I give you these examples, a product is simply a platform for delivering services. The value in this treadmill now is moved to the screen. It's gone into software. So that's fitness. Now let's take another example, cars. This is connected automobiles. What Tesla is doing to automobiles, well, it's not the you know, the important innovation here, of course, it's an electric car, and it goes really fast, and I have one, it goes like crazy. But the real innovation is, it's a connected appliance. It is software on wheels. And what they're therefore able to do is that it is an appliance that's in the cloud. I'll give you a couple of examples. This blew my mind. This happened to me in January. It was really cold. I was driving, and I see that it gives you the rated power and then the actual range you're going to get, and it was lower. So I called the service center as I'm driving. I said, why is my power consumption high? He said, let me pull up the diagnostics on your car as I'm driving. He's pulling it from my car because it's cloud connected, right? And then he says, I'm benchmarking it against everybody who owns a Tesla within 20 miles of where you live so we can correct for weather and temperature differences. And he says, it all looks good. You're within the parameters, but you're starting your car cold. So in the winter, use your app, turn the car on 5 minutes because there are 5 heaters in the battery, and that will give you the better mileage. Done. That's diagnostics in the cloud. In real time, that car is transmitting information. I noticed when they downloaded the autopilot came over the air. One day in the morning, I wake up, my car rebooted over Wi-Fi, and suddenly it has autopilot to drive itself. No touch with the dealer. And that autopilot, when I was using it for the first month, I noticed on Lakeshore Drive there's some sharp turns, and the car kind of turns like this. And you get nervous, right? When it's like, well, is it going to turn or not? So you hit the brake and you go off autopilot. The algorithm detects this. 60,000 cars are transmitting data in real time. So the algorithm says, if turn greater than 45 degrees, then people are hitting the brake. Oh, we need to correct the turning algorithm. And the download and update, a week later, my car now turns smoothly. What they've announced this week is very, very fundamental. All Teslas will now have level 5 autonomy. Level 5 autonomy means you will be able to drive in next year from LA to Times Square and get dropped off 3,000 miles without touching anything, including charging. There will be a robotic charger a snake charger is going to come and charge your car. So all Teslas starting today will have level 5 autonomy. People keep talking about it, Google's talking about it, they're testing it, they've done it. So my car has one camera, they'll now have 8 cameras. It has 40 times the processing power that my car has, which I bought a year ago. It's a supercomputer with 8 cameras. It has medium range, short range, soft body detection, radar, LiDAR, so it knows what a human being is and it knows what a hard object is based on the difference in the way that the beams come back. So it is essentially now. That is not what's fundamental. What is even more fundamental is that you can now imagine that if your husband and wife and you share a car, it drops me off to work and then goes and picks you up, comes back home, takes you grocery shopping, and then goes back to the parking lot. So essentially, Tesla will enable a private cloud where you can now share your car and you can actually make money by saying, okay, my car's in the garage now, why don't you go run around for a few hours, make some money for me. So you can give access to your car to anybody through the app, and the car can show up wherever and do whatever. So basically, you got your Uber within your family or within your social network. It's a private version of Uber. That's what they've announced. So it completely changes the concept of transportation. It now becomes, you're not buying a car, you're buying access to transportation. Of course, Ford, General Motors, all these people are also getting into the act, and this is a highly competitive space. So this will change, all these autonomous cars have the potential to change cities. They will liberate parking lots and reduce rents, because now the real estate, football fields upon football fields of parking lots can be eliminated. 45% of the gas spent in Manhattan is cars looking for parking. All that will be eliminated. So this has some very, very fundamental changes. So that's the idea of what a connectivity does. So let's look at the patterns of disruption, the designs of disruption. So I've tried to simplify this and give them some catchy names. So one is disruption at the market level. So this is a disruption by creating innovative ways to match supply and demand, and in fact bring new sources of supply into the marketplace. So it's a market level disruption. So this is something I'll call Uberization. The second kind of disruption is disrupting the product, changing the structure of the product and making it into a service or something that is accessible over a network. So now I replace ownership with access. I survey size. So that's the second model. The third is the one that I think you're most familiar with, which is disruption of the channel, which is the way that customers access and buy your products and services, and that's Amazonization. So let's look at these in turn. So Uberization. So in Uberization, what we're talking about is an on-demand marketplace. There are two types of marketplaces, asset marketplaces and labor marketplaces. In each case, what you have is a high value but underutilized asset. This asset can be a human being's skilled labor, or it can be a fixed asset like a boat, a car, and or a house, you know, and so on. So what they're doing here is they're monetizing underutilized assets. I was with Cessna Aircraft three, four months ago in Wichita, and one of the perks of working with Cessna is they send you a Cessna to take you there for the meeting, which was, and it's a brand new, the demonstrator plane. My plane had 6 hours on it, so which is good and bad. And the meeting, they tell me that the average utilization of a Cessna Citation jet is 0.6 hours a day. I almost fell off my chair. I'm like, you know, that's crying out for Uberization. So anyway, your car is used on average 5%, right? So there's just a ton of stuff, excavators, you know, boats. Just look at how much capacity is out there that can be brought into the marketplace. The other interesting thing about these marketplaces, they bring latent supply into the marketplace. Uber did not take taxi drivers and create taxis. They brought new supply. It's people who are part-timers. I did not know I was a landlord. I was living in a house. I had a little coach house at the back of my house. I'm like, wait, I can use this Airbnb to rent it. I suddenly now become a hotel operator. It's new supply. So they're expanding the supply base, bringing in contingent supply into the marketplace. And usually they will orchestrate a network without owning any assets, a very asset-light model, and it creates strong network externalities. By the way, what is Airbnb? It is in a logical further fractionation of timeshares. Right? Timeshare, you buy an eighth or a 16th, and now what I do is I buy a day. What is a labor marketplace? It's an extension of the consulting model. It's a consultant, it's a fractional employee. I hire them for a month at a time, 2 months at a time. Now I can hire a lawyer for an hour. So it's basically just making it more granular. It's in a continuum of full-time ownership of the asset or full-time employment of an employee down to something that is. And if you think about the math here, this model makes more and more sense as you need access to very skilled people infrequently and intermittently. Or you need access to a very expensive asset, like an excavator, for like 3 hours, but then I don't need it for the next 6 months. That's where these marketplaces add a lot of value. And this is actually Uber for excavators, Yard Club. And Caterpillar has an investment in it, right? So this is a service. I know I've talked to you about this. You still need to sign up, Arjun. It's called Jet Smarter. You've heard of Jet Sentient Jet and Net Jets. They fractionate a jet, right? They fractionate the seats within a jet. So if you pay them $10,000 a year, you can fly unlimited private jet flights. And these are G5s flying between, and they have scheduled flights between Chicago and LA and Chicago, New York, Chicago, Miami, and they're building a whole airline network. And they basically lease the aircraft from the people who are underutilized. So, you know, so that's this happening with boats, and it's happening with people. You can now get house calls. The doctor is back. You can get them for an hour. Right? So logo and web design. This is actually a Chicago company called CrowdSpring. And you can get a lawyer on demand. So this is the marketplace. Now, are you at risk of Uberization? Ask yourself, do you create or sell a service that relies on high-value assets or high-value human capital? By the way, we are subject to Uberization. We are high-value human capital. And we are underutilized. That doesn't mean we're underworked. What it means is this form factor, where I'm in front of 60 people, is very inefficient. Why are there not 100 more people, 500 not more people on telepresence right now? Why am I not also taking this, recording it and selling the videos? You know, why am I? So the reason that education is so expensive is because we don't scale. And we have to figure out how to solve this problem. Otherwise, you know, we will kill our... I'm sorry, Paul, but you got a tough job. You know, when we're charging $180,000 for an executive MBA, that is criminal. And we got to figure out how to scale that. So we have to disrupt ourselves. Otherwise, somebody... And in fact, we are actually talking to people who are doing disruptive stuff in India and other places. So so we got to get in bed with these people. So if you do sell capital good, do your customers utilize these assets less than 25% of the time? If so, you're in trouble, right? Do your customers use your product or service only occasionally, and is there latent capacity that can be brought online in your market? So that's the first model. Second model is servicization. So here the idea is that these are disruptors who add software-based intelligence and sensors and instrumentation to assets that permits the assets to become a service, or to create the services attached to the asset. This is the future of General Electric. GE predicts operating system will be the, they want to become the Android for industrial assets. So this is turbines and locomotives talking. So the idea here is that software is eating the value in every product. Software ate your, now of course software ate your camera, software ate your book, software ate your music player. Software is now eating your car, as in Tesla. Software is going to eat your home. The value is going to move to software in every single product and service we own. What I mean by that is if I'm selling a $500,000 medical diagnostic machine, the value now will be in the data analysis and the imaging and the services that I provide. So the product becomes a shell. The product is a platform for service delivery. You know, it's just a hook for doing relation. And if you think about it that way, it can be very disruptive in pricing, because I can give away potentially a $500,000 diagnostic machine if you sign a contract for service for 5 years, right? So the revenue model shifts to subscription-based services. Sensors and instrumentation allow you to do asset optimization and operations optimization, whether it's heat rates in boilers in plants or it's wind farms asset optimization. So let's look at some examples here. We know this is happening in the world of software. This is where it all started, servicization, right? SaaS, PaaS, IaaS, software as a service, infrastructure as a service, AWS, Amazon Web Services now is a $10 billion business, and it makes more money than all of Amazon's put together multiplied by 10. Because Amazon runs a 3% margin business, this is a 13% margin business. So now more than half of Amazon's profits are coming from AWS, and this was just started on the side. You know, this has become the main event. They might as well shut down the whole website and just run the cloud business. Microsoft just came up with his numbers 3 days ago. Azure was up 100%. They've doubled the revenues, and Microsoft's stock is at an all-time high. It's because they've moved to the cloud very, very aggressively. What is this? This is a drone, but not the kind of drones that you play with. This is made by Textron. It's a military drone. And the business model for this drone is the military doesn't buy these drones. They get paid based on pixels over target. How many? I'm telling you to serve, to watch, Mosul. And these are the areas I need you to surveil for me. I'm going to pay you based on how many high-value images you produce for over that target. So the whole business model has changed now. It's become a subscription. I subscribe to your services. It gets crazy. This is street lights, right? So I met this lady from GE Lighting. So what they've done with street lights is they put sound sensors into the street lights that detect gunshots. You know, so if you kind of have to shoot somebody, you got to see them. So there's a street light somewhere. So 1 in 10 gunshots get reported to police in time for them to show up. So imagine a situation where GE says, I'm going to sell you crime monitoring and surveillance as a service. By the way, the light bulb is free. So I was talking to a gentleman at Michelin. I said, have you thought about tire as a service? He's like, all of that work, it's a tire, it's not digital. What do I do with a tire as a service? I said, hang on. You've got a commercial fleet of trucks. You can instrument the tires, and you can monitor wear, and you can monitor inflation level. And you can monitor exactly how much the tire has been used. So now I give you full analytics on how your tire fleet is doing. I can tell you this tire is now due for replacement. The tread level's gone down to the point where it's dangerous. Oh, by the way, this is underinflated, so you're losing 15% gas mileage if you don't inflate the tire. So I will sell you the tire and this monitoring service. You subscribe to my tire. You pay me $50 a month per tire. So that's the idea, you know, anything. So the idea here is that if your product can be infused with software-based intelligence, and if it can be connected to a network, it's up for grabs. It can be redefined. And today, many of these fixed assets, whether they are, as I said, you know, boilers in plants or wind turbines or locomotives or aircraft, you will be able to create a subscription-based model. So that's serviceization, right? The third model is something that I think you're more familiar with, is Amazonization. So here the concept is that you essentially create a direct-to-customer model and take out middlemen through this and create efficiencies. Not only do you create efficiencies, you also use customer data as a competitive advantage because now you have, you know, information. I think Amazon's value proposition is that much stronger because of the quality of data that they have. This is a Chicago-based startup. I met this guy. He's an optometrist. This is I'm on the board of the Chicago Innovation Awards, so I met this fellow through him. It's called Opternative. So here's how it works. You open up the website, and you open up the app. And then the website says, what is your shoe size? And you say, it's 11. And he says, okay, walk 12 steps away from your screen, and look at your screen, and the app will ask you a question. What do you see? What do you see? What do you see? It does your eye exam and says, here's your prescription. Buy now, right? So it's called Opternative Optical, you know. So this guy actually had three optometrists on his advisory board. Those guys got death threats because they're like, you're killing our business. The optometrist does nothing of value. The ophthalmologist does something of value. If I'm just sitting there moving, you know, can you see this? Can you see this? Can you see this? That's gone. If you are doing any low-value work in today's economy, there's a robot coming after you. There's an algorithm coming after you. So that's the challenge. And by the way, they say I can go direct now, buy the glasses, and I'm done. Imagine the efficiency that they would create this way. So he's working on it, this local guy. Oh, by the way, his clinical trials have shown this is superior, the result, than because the optometrists make mistakes. So that's the, and you can take it over and over again. You don't have to travel. You can do this in your house. So anyway, check it out, by the way. This is my student in Brazil. She's cut out the banks in credit cards. What happened, this is true. In Brazil, if you want a credit card, you have to go to the bank physically. You know, and you get a statement once a month in the mail, after which you find out how many hidden fees have been socked at you, right? The interest rates are 10 to 12% per month, not per year, per month. So what she's done is created a credit card that is provisioned entirely over a smartphone. There is no other way you can get this card. There's no website. By the way, websites are passe. Forget about websites. It's all on the device now. So, and there's an Apple Watch version too. So it's issued over a smartphone. The only way she interacts is by digital channels, and there's social, all marketing is done over social media, and that allows her to offer much better rates, and she's got 2 million customers and 1 million on the waiting list because they don't want to give out credit, you know, without doing due diligence. So this is usually disruptive, you know. So think about the last time you interact with a bank or a credit card. If you don't have this level of, oh, by the way, the other thing she's able to do now in real time, these color codes are categories. You can see what your category spending is. You can put budgets. There's a lot of stuff you can do on the app, which you can't do on a mail statement. So that's disruption, right? So Amazonization basic idea here is that there's one simple metric, two simple metrics. One is you ask yourself, what percentage of your category sales are over e-commerce, and what percentage of your sales are over e-commerce? So take Walmart, for instance, right? I mean, Walmart is selling $14 billion over e-commerce out of $420 billion, 3%. But 12% of retail is e-commerce. That I'll tell you, wait a minute, Houston, we have a problem because we are under-penetrated relative to in. Second, very interesting diagnostic question is, what is your market share amongst young people? Right? So this is a very simple question. So, you know, if your share amongst millennials is lower, that means you've got a problem because those people are moving to these direct models. Third thing you gotta ask yourself is, what does your distribution channel do for you? What exactly does it do for you? And what I feel is going to happen is that we're going to take the services provided by middlemen, we're going to unbundle them. And I'm going to tell my brokers in insurance that I want you to do advice, but I don't want you to do origination. I'm going to handle that. I'm going to handle customer care. So I'm going to break it down. And by the way, instead of 30%, now you get 10%. You want it? Otherwise, I'm going direct. So there are certain things that will still need touch, but the way I believe the structure of channels and retail is going to get transformed over the next 5 years. Couple of examples. Citibank smart branches, 700 square feet. There are no people doing money and checks. And in fact, if you want to talk to somebody and get advice, you go into a video consult room. You open up a telepresence call, and you're connected to New York with the guy who's an expert in hedge funds or private equity, you know, extremely specialized in my neighborhood, because I'm time-sharing this person now with 10 other branches. So I can provide very special, it's a hub-and-spoke model. I've got specialized expertise. I can push this out, and the branch now is just digital displays, and you come in and do your stuff. It's just like a big website. The flip side is also happening. So the analog people are going digital. The digital people are going analog. Blue Nile, the jewelry online seller, has created web rooms, 500 square feet jewelry shops that don't have any inventory. You go there, you do your sizing, you check the ring out, whatever it is, and they order it online in the store. So if I built retail stores today, they would look nothing like Walmart. They would look nothing like Safeway. So the future of retail is retail should be theater. Retail should be the experience. There is no joy I get out of seeing paper towels and diapers in a grocery store. They should come auto-replenishment, delivered to your house, and I should see their fresh produce and flowers and meats and stuff that excites me. So that's the future of malls, that's the future of retail, and I think retail is going to get transformed because all these middlemen have to ask, what is it that cannot be done digitally? So I was advising Best Buy, Hubert Joly and his team, and what the idea we came up with there was, for everything that Amazon has, what are the privileged assets that Best Buy has? Their privileged assets are the stores, which for demonstration. They have blue shirts. They have Geek Squad. They have the ability to install, to maintain. And in fact, I was joking with Hubert. I said, stop selling stuff. Install for Amazon. Become the service center for Amazon. So one of the ideas I gave them, I said, why don't you create tell me if you would be interested in service like this, a digital concierge that says, you pay $50 a month, I got you. I'll install, maintain, your iPhone breaks, whatever, I got you. I do trade-ins, I do warranty, extended warranty, I do installation, I do maintenance, I do wireless, I do repair, and you know, I'm your IT solution for your house. Because it's becoming more complicated. So never mind the TVs and all that they're selling, because nobody wants to buy that from you. Anyway, so that's so how do we deal with this? You know, we can deal with this in four different ways. So, and these are, as I said, they start with the most disruptive strategy, which is kill yourself, right? The turkeys don't like to vote for Thanksgiving, but you know, that is, the second is, if you can't beat them, buy them, right? That's acquisition, acquire a disruptor. The third is to act like a disruptor, adapt, and incorporate the disruptor's practices and business models. And the fourth, this is the simplest, and something that every company needs to do, is go digital. Digitize your enterprise, digitize your customer experience, you know, and become more agile. So let's look at these, you know, attack. So in attack, the idea is that you come up with a disruptive model that disrupts the disruptor, and you do it by leveraging the privileged assets that you have that they don't. And you do it in a way that actually may kill your core revenue stream. That's why this requires a lot of intestinal fortitude. So what is HBO doing? HBO is getting disrupted by Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, the streaming services. What does HBO have that these guys don't? Content, right? Because this year, Netflix will spend $6 billion in original content. They will produce 1,000 hours of programming, which is way more than any network does. So that's the new studio. But anyway, so HBO has, in the meantime, pretty good content. So they announced they're going to go streaming. When they go streaming, the cable Comcast is not very happy. You know, they're like, wait a minute, you're bypassing us. And they're like, yeah, we will kill that business because we got to create this other business. We're going to disrupt ourselves. By the way, Netflix, we talk about them as disruptive. They killed themselves too. Remember, they used to run DVDs by mail? They killed that business. And their stock crashed, lost 80% of its value. And at that point, it bought their stock. You know, you don't want an island in the Bahamas. Right? So that's the idea of disrupting yourself, which is where you say, I'm good. You should only do this if your core revenue stream is under attack, if your death is imminent and certain. If you know the market's moving. Netflix knew that the future is streaming. So there is no business hanging on to DVDs by mail. So they proactively went and destroyed their business, but created this new business, right? So if the transition is happening quickly, you really need to move. By the way, this is what Microsoft has done with its cloud business. And this is what Adobe did. Adobe in 2013 announced that you cannot any longer buy Adobe software. You have to subscribe to it. It's only available in the cloud. You know what happened to their revenues a year later? 64% drop in the revenue. You know what's happened to their stock? Go check out when you go home, check out Adobe stock. It has quadrupled, and it went straight up in spite of the revenue decline because people saw the future. So the second strategy is to keep cannibals in your family. Bring them in, right? So it's acquire. So this is Allstate buying Esure, and since Walmart buying Jet.com. So very interesting question I want to ask you. What did Walmart buy when they bought Jet.com? And let me put this differently. There are two end games for Jet.com, that it becomes a strong e-commerce business that's independent versus it gets absorbed into Walmart's e-commerce operation. What would you like to do? Tell me. Be absorbed? Why? But, I mean, if e-commerce is growing, I can grow this e-commerce business on the side. And I don't want to get infected by all this nonsense that goes on in Bentonville. By the way, you're right. I'm just like giving you a hard time. So if Walmart kept Jet.com entirely siloed and independent, it would grow from a $2 billion business to maybe a $10 billion business. That's nice. That's interesting. But if they brought the DNA and infected all of the Walmart's e-commerce and took the $14 billion to $40 billion, that's far more interesting. So what they are buying is capabilities. They're buying the team. They're buying really the expertise that will move the needle in the mothership. The problem with that, though, is that entrepreneurs don't like working for motherships, and they don't like living in Arkansas. So I wrote a Forbes article on this. It was called Walmart and Jet.com, The Marriage Will Not Be Easy. Because big companies have a long history of smothering these startups that they acquire. So not easy to do. So there's a stepped process you need to take. If you want to create a disruptive startup, either through acquisition or by your own incubation, first two steps are you isolate it and you incubate it. Then you infiltrate into the core business and integrate it. Now, if you don't do these two steps, the antibodies will kill it, it won't even get started. If you don't do these two steps, you'll create a digital silo. And that's not very interesting. So this is the way. So I'm advising a lot of companies as they are setting up their innovation units. I said, do it at arm's length, do it outside a business unit, make it report to the CEO, but then have a clear integration path. This is like the rocket re-entering the atmosphere, it gets really hot. You know, that's what you need to do, is to infuse the core organization with that DNA. So that's critical, right? So in acquiring a disruptor, the first question, by the way, why did Walmart have to buy Jet.com? Because it was faster and more feasible to buy than build. They've been doing building for 20 years, right? So they've been doing building for 20 years. They did Walmart.com in 1998. Didn't go any. In fact, Carter Cash was the CEO of Walmart.com, now teaches for us. So it's really about now being able to bring this DNA. It's kind of like grafting. You bring in a graft. And the metaphor I love to think about here is that old roots and new shoots make great fruits, right? But you need to be able to infuse that new DNA, but keep the core assets, you know, the assets that Walmart has, distribution, brand, so on and so forth. Okay? Then the third thing you can do is to transform your value proposition. This is adapting. Here what I'm saying is I reconceptualize what I do. I completely rethink my business. So AT&T is buying Time Warner. Good luck. But anyway, that's me. But the idea there is that you know, there is no money in continuing to saturate dumb pipes. That they even need to think about getting into the content business. I think it's, you know, I think it's not going to work. But let me tell you about a company that I just came from their board meeting. We're setting up a company in India. It's a digital services company, the largest startup in the world, and that's this company called Jio. And because there are, you know, India has 850 million mobile subscriptions. And essentially, what we're doing here is we banned the term telecom. You cannot use the word telecom inside the company. We're a digital ecosystem, digital services company. So this company has movies on demand, payments, television, live TV, 300 channels of live TV, data, voice, video, chat, small business. You know, it's basically Amazon plus Netflix plus PayPal plus AT&T put together. And the ARPU we will have, the average revenue per user, will be $3 to $5. But we'll have 300 million subscribers. Do the math. That's a $20 billion business. This business will be within 2 months of launch. We launched in 5th September. We're running more data than Verizon. That's how. And we're in the first, I can only announce what we did in the first 26 days. First 26 days, we acquired 16 million subscribers. We're adding a million people a day. So that's the scale at which, but it's really about giving them a full experience, and you don't pay for voice. All calls are free. You don't pay for the video. You don't pay for the channels. All you buy is data. That's it. And data is 50 rupees per gigabyte, which is 70 cents per gigabyte. I want you to look at your plan and see how much you spend on a gigabyte. So anyway, so those are the numbers. And this business will be profitable, EBITDA positive in 2 years with a $20 billion CapEx. So anyway, that's kind of the economics of extreme scale and transformation. The third thing, last thing you can do is to digitize the enterprise, right? Here you need to think about how can I use the digital capabilities and infuse them into the, starting like if I was a bank X, I would be fixing my user experience. I would be fixing my front office. So here I want to talk to you about what's going on with the front office. So what happened in the old days, marketing used to work like this, broadcast, right? We had these different front office functions, commerce, sales, care, research, and then you had these channels. Then what did we do? We have social media. What happens now is we got all these channels. But we didn't get rid of these silos. Now, worse, we created these silos now. There's a team doing Twitter, a team doing mobile, a team doing Facebook, and then there's still the team doing traditional media. This is a mess, because what's happening is that we've built channel and function-specific systems, and this doesn't scale. This is getting more and more complicated because at last count there were 26 social channels, and you need a channel agnostic system. So this is where we are at now in automation. So here's the problem. Social requires these functions, right? Content planning, campaign management, publishing, engagement, CRM, reporting, governance. And then you used to have 6 channels, phone, email. Now you have 26. So you do the math, see? 26 times these functions, how many silos have you created? And the customer says, I don't know what the hell's going on, right? So what you need is a unified system of engagement that connects all these, and this is the experience cloud. Cloud is coming to customer experience. Social experience management will be the new future. So this, just like we had a system of record, which was our ERP systems, we will now have a system of engagement, which will be the platform that manages all of our customer interaction. Not only customers, HR, R&D, you know, anywhere you need to touch a stakeholder, PR. So these are the functionalities that you will have in there, and it'll exist, it'll connect to your existing technology system, where it'll be conversations, community, collaboration, campaigns, and content. These are the elements of social experience management, and this platform exists today. So one of the things that I'm doing is working with a company called Sprinklr that is building this whole SAP for the front office. Their valuation has already hit $2 billion. They raised $100 million, and they have McDonald's, they have Nike, they have Procter & Gamble, they have, so these companies are realizing the potential of really the unified front office with all of these elements built into it. So we've seen this movie before. What did SAP do? It unified our product information, and allowed us to now manage the supply chain more effectively because now I can track a unified product ID. What is happening with back office work is you have an employee ID that allows you to track all of the people going through this. The future is very simple, that the front office, through a unified customer ID, will be able to track them through all of the interactions they have with us, and it will all be managed in a unified way. So this is the way to digitize the front office of the enterprise. So in summary, some of the capabilities that you don't need, and I'm gonna conclude with a very simple observation. Whenever expertise is unevenly distributed and you're trying to build a new capability in an organization, it makes sense to concentrate it in a center of excellence. So you need a chief digital officer. You need digital expertise concentrated because otherwise you're not going to get the traction. I've seen this movie 20 years ago when we had e-commerce departments, right? So I'm going to write an article which is going to be called Long Live the Chief Digital Officer, Kill the Digital Chief Digital Officer. The moment the expertise gets mature, you need to destroy this. So similarly, like you don't have e-commerce departments anymore, this just became commerce. But in the short run, you need this crutch, you need to get the momentum. So today, a CDO and a COE, a center of excellence, is critical, but long term, it should just go away. Digital will become the way we do business. I'm gonna stop here. Thank you all.
Very much. So in the interest of time, I'm gonna ask us to hold off on questions for Mohan. I know he's coming back to join us, I hope, for lunch. So if you
I'll be here for lunch so we can.
So if you have a question, please, we'll take it there. But since we only have about an hour left, I'd like to make sure we get a chance to hear from Florian Zettelmeyer. Florian is a chaired professor of marketing at Kellogg School, and he is the director of our program on data analytics at Kellogg, or PDAC. His research and teaching focuses on evaluating the effects of information technology on firms, both what we as consumers know about firms as well as what they know about us. Quickly, he got his he's won all sorts of outstanding professor awards at Kellogg. He earned his master's, I think, at the University of Warwick, right? And his PhD from MIT in Boston. So here to talk to us more about modern advertising on social media channels, please join me in welcoming Florian Zettelmeyer.
Now it is. Okay, so I want to talk about modern advertising, but, you know, as a German, I have a keen sense of history. So I think that everything needs to be seen through the lens of history. And so I thought I would actually start us off with the following problem, which is a very, very old problem. So, you know, this is going to be a talk ultimately about a disruption that's happening right now in a really big industry that is creating a lot of pain. And I'm going to tell you, sort of at the end of this, you're going to be slightly depressed, okay? So I should tell you that right up front. So this is not going to be like, you know, the world is going to be rosy, but I'm going to show you sort of how in practice you take an industry, you take a digital revolution that hit the industry, and you now think everything got better and it didn't get better. And so the end of my story is not everything got better, okay? So that's just prepare yourself emotionally for that. So. Let me start with the way things used to be. So here's sort of the way advertising really worked for a long time. Yeah. So obviously, advertising in newsprint has been around for a long time, and then with the advent of television, you know, this is. I want you to sort of think back to the 1950s and 60s and 70s and 80s before the internet came around. And let me ask you just this question, which is: imagine you're a company. And you're running an ad, okay, like on TV, or you're running an ad in a newspaper, how do you tell how well it worked? Okay, but B, I'm gonna push you to be more specific. So what exactly are you, so what I want you to give me is, imagine that you're going to do a presentation to the head of marketing at the company, okay, you're an employee, and now you're going to show this head of marketing a bunch of numbers. What numbers are you going to show them? Oh, well, okay, before we get cynical, let's try to actually sort of figure out how would you come up with those numbers? So you said sales, but what exactly do you mean with sales? Okay, so what you're talking about is kind of traditional market research, which give you an idea of how well it might work. But at the end of the day, you've just spent $2 million on an ad campaign, and somebody wants to know more than whether a room of 20 people liked it or not. So how would you tell whether that worked? Okay, so that's exactly right. So one thing you might do is that in January you're not running the campaign, in February you're running the campaign, and then you compare the sales in January with the sales in February, right? Okay, what's the problem with that? Seasonality, exactly. So a lot of different things change between January and February. Maybe there was a snowstorm, and your product is somehow related to buying things when the snowstorm happens, yeah? And so it's very hard to somehow figure out how to do that. Okay, so what else could we do? Okay, brand recognition. So, but again, what you would do is you would sort of ask people before you ran the campaign how much they recognize the brand and after they run the campaign. Okay, maybe there was an article written in the New York Times about it in the meantime, and it's not your advertising. Any other ideas? Yeah. Okay, so what you're trying to propose is to sort of say, maybe I can get consumers to identify themselves as who has seen the ad, and then I can somehow compare the people who saw the ad and those who didn't see the ad. That often turns also to be problematic because even if you know who saw the ad, often you don't know whether people bought. Think of a traditional retail structure, right? I mean, you're advertising Charmin. Where does Charmin get sold? Everywhere. So how do you get to link whether people saw the ad to whether they bought it on CVS or in DeJewel or at... So I don't know if you're getting the idea here, but this is a nightmare, okay? It really is a nightmare. It's extraordinarily hard to figure out whether and how advertising worked. And so, you know, and the basic problems from a measurement point of view is that we don't know who saw an ad, except for, you know, in some very rare cases where you can maybe produce incentives like that, but it's really tough to figure out who saw an ad. I mean, remember, we're talking about print and television, okay? And at the same time, you know, we also don't know who purchased. So the best we can typically do is to get like a sense for how many people saw the ad, and we can get a sense for how many products were purchased, and then you know, the replies in the room kind of covered it, which is the best you can kind of do is sort of figure out how it was beforehand and how it was afterwards, and then you say, okay, between January and February, I got 2 million more people to see to be aware of my product, so the ad, and I somehow sold 200,000 more widgets. And that's what the effect of advertising is. And there are huge problems as to whether that's correct or not correct, on, you know, whether it's driven by coincidence or other stuff was going on, et cetera. Okay. And all of this has led to the perhaps most famous and most overused marketing quote of all history, which is, half the money I spend on advertising is wasted. The trouble is, I don't know which half, okay? And this is by a man called John Wanamaker. This quote shows up like in a third of all marketing academic presentations. But it shows up because it is so fundamental. Okay, so now let's talk about the disruption. Yeah, we're here on a seminar about digital media or about media and the influence today and tomorrow. And so digital obviously is sort of the media of today and of tomorrow. So in 1994, Wired, which you know as a magazine, right? Wired as a website, as a magazine, came up with the first opportunity of having a banner ad. And this first banner ad that you see here was for AT&T. And you know, it was literally, this is what the ad was. It was sort of, you know, this baiting you to click up there. And so this now had enormous promise, suddenly, to solve this problem that we just all dealt with. And the promise basically was that you could now track everything that happened. So the first thing you would do is you could track an individual person's computer. And I don't, and so you may have heard this word. This is this word called a cookie. And a cookie is essentially a, it sounds far fancier than it is. There's a text file on your computer. And in the text file, there is sort of every row is an entry. And if you are a website, you can look in that file and see whether there's already a pre-existing entry you made in that file. And this allows you to link a visit with the next visit over time. So if, for example, you go into a website, have you noticed sometimes your email is already filled in before you type in your password? That happens because they've read your cookie, and then they fill in your password, your email already. So that's basically a way how to keep track over time that it was you. Okay. So you can track a computer. All right. So the next thing we can now do is, if I can track a computer online, I can now track whether or not you get exposed to an advertising. So you might wonder, how does that work? Okay, the way this works is as follows, which is that the ad, typically, is not actually embedded in the actual page that gets loaded, but the ad gets requested by the browser from a third party, okay? And in the moment that you know how, like, if you have a web page, there's the text, and then there are the pictures that get filled in. And these pictures can reside anywhere. They don't have to reside on the same server where the text is. And so what would happen is that you would pull that from some other place, and then in the process of pulling, you also look at your cookie. And so now you know that for person XYZ, for Dina, for example, I know that it was you, and I know that I pulled an ad and I showed it to you. So now I know that it was you, and I know that you saw an ad, or at least that the ad showed up on the browser. Okay, now it gets further, because now the next step is I can now not only see that Dina saw an ad, but I can maybe observe whether she clicked on the ad. Okay? So now I have got that link too. So now I have a measure of how engaged you were with the advertising. Okay? Okay. So the next step then is that once you click on the ad, maybe it'll send me to an e-commerce website. I put Amazon as an example. Okay? So Amazon, of course, also reads my cookie. So now they know that I'm on Amazon. All right? And so now I know, you notice how I've now created this link now from, I know who you are, I know you saw the ad, I know you engaged with the ad, I now know you're on a website. And now comes the last piece, which is, now did you buy or not? And of course, I know that too, because this is the easy part. You have to log in to get the stuff shipped to you, okay? So what I have now done is I have completely linked everything from who you are to did you see an ad to did you buy. And you notice like that our whole problem that we thought we had early on advertising has just vanished. Because I now know for every person who is digitally, or at least for many people who are digitally, I know whether you saw an ad, what you did with it, and whether you purchased in response. John Wanamaker would have died in heaven for that. What do you call it? What's the expression in English? You would have done in something and died, went to heaven? Died and gone to heaven, exactly. All right. So, now, imagine we can do that. The next step then is to say, okay, so once we are able to track these consumer activities, this is a quote from the founder of Comscore, which is maybe the most prominent advertising measurement firm in the country today, okay? And he basically wrote an HBR article in which he describes to kind of people who want to do digital advertising the following. He says, measuring the online sales impact of an online ad campaign is straightforward. We determine who has viewed the ad. Then we compare online purchases made by those who have and online purchases those who have not seen it. And now we're done. So basically, I have two groups of people, right? So I see sort of Dina and friends have seen the ad, and Diane and friends have not seen the ad. Now I basically look, you know, did you guys buy more than you guys? And now I know what the effect of the ad is. That's the basic idea, okay? So to make this very concrete, what happens is that you compare people who are exposed on advertising to those who are not. And so now imagine that I have a target group, like I tell a website, I would like to target the ad to women 18 to 49. Now what they do is not everybody of that group is going to necessarily see the ad because maybe some of you didn't go online on that particular day or you did something else, you didn't have opportunity to see it. But some will, and so now you have this exposed group, let's say that 3% of you purchase. Among those who didn't see the ad, only 1% purchase, and now you can say, okay, the incremental effect of the ad is this 2 percentage point bump in sales. Yeah, and the way this is typically expressed in the industry is with what's called a lift. And the lift basically is the change in the effect of the ad on purchases, 3% minus 1%, divided by the baseline, the 1%. So in this case, what this means is, look, the ad led to a 200% increase in purchases. Everybody okay? Okay, so far you're not depressed, right? Good. Because I haven't told you anything depressing so far. Okay. So, it turns out digital media has massively improved the collection of these measures, but has it solved the advertising effectiveness measurement problem? Yes, you know too much. That's right. Okay, so.
Repeat what she said for
it. Yeah, oh, she says you're still in correlational world, and I said you know too much, exactly. Okay, so, all right, so what I now need to do is, and you know, I'll give you a little preview. What this is going to be sort of a story on is how an increase in possibilities of measurement of data, etc., really starts stressing what you need to be able to do as a business person. And if what's happening out there isn't accompanied by an equal increase in skills and thinking sophisticatedly about this new world they're in, things get into trouble. And that's essentially what this is about. So let me explain to you a little bit what I mean. So let's just for a moment completely step back and ask the following question. If we really wanted to measure advertising at a very conceptual level in a world without constraints on what data we have, how would we do it? Okay. And basically, what we would really like to do is something like this. How would a consumer behave in two alternative worlds that are identical except for one difference? In the one world, they see an ad, and in the other world, they don't see an ad. Okay. So, and when I mean identical worlds, I mean literally identical worlds. I mean cloned worlds, okay? So I mean, you know, no disrespect to you, I want Diane's hair in both worlds to be exactly the same, down to the last little strand. I want, what is the smallest particle we know about these days? Is it a Higgs boson or, okay. I want this, the Higgs bosons to be in the same place in both worlds, okay? This is, of course, a figment of the imagination. This doesn't exist. But that's the mental exercise I want to do. Now, if it were so that in the one world I saw the ad, and I showed an ad, and in the other I didn't show an ad, and everything was identical about these two worlds, then I could conclude that the ad was responsible for the difference in purchases between those two worlds. Does that make sense? Right? Because it's the only thing that differs between the two worlds, so it literally can be the only reason why things will be different in those two worlds, okay? And that is kind of the ideal experiment I have in mind. It's sort of, there's the Shirley Ryan in world one and the Shirley Ryan in world two, and in one world I observe Shirley buying and in the other observe Shirley not buying, and now I know this must be the effect of the ad on Shirley because otherwise nothing else is different. Sounds good? That's the ideal, okay. So it turns out that this here is the fundamental problem of scientific discovery is that you can never be in two worlds at once, okay? So this, in fact, is a problem that the medical school has, that the physics department has, everybody has this problem. And in other words, to be very precise, the fact that you see an ad precludes you from not seeing the ad, and the fact that you didn't see the ad precludes you from seeing the ad at least at the same time, okay? Okay, so it turns out we have a solution to this problem. And the solution to this problem is what we call an experiment. And an experiment, or as it's to be, often people misuse the word experiment, so I'm going to use the technical term for experiment that signifies to those in the know that you know what you're talking about, and it's called a randomized controlled trial, or an RCT. Yeah, a randomized controlled trial is sort of the gold standard of scientific discovery. Okay? This is what a medical school does when they run a test on a cancer drug. Okay, so the idea behind an experiment is this. I take a group of people, and I randomly allocate them into two worlds. These aren't really worlds, but I sort of am going to pretend they're worlds. And I sometimes call them experimental conditions, or A-B conditions, or treatment and control conditions, okay? And what I then do is, after I've randomly allocated them, so I literally flip a coin and put them in one group or the other, I then show one group the ad, and the other group I don't show the ad, and then I observe one outcome and the other outcome, and the difference between those two outcomes, that is the actual effect that's caused by the ad. Okay, so let me explain to you why this works, okay? So the reason this works is as follows. So let's just pretend the following. Let me say that, we have so my standard example has a mixed gender audience. So I'm just gonna pretend that you're a mixture of men and women. Is that okay? Okay, so here we go. So imagine that I take all of you and I randomize you to either sit on this or that side of the room, okay? And so I would ask you to all get up, reshuffle depending on my randomization, and sit down again. So now we have, for every person, had the same chance of being on the right or the left side of the room. Okay. So now let's split the room in two, and you guys got exposed to an ad and you don't get exposed to an ad. And let's say it's a full of jewelry product. Okay, and a jewelry product typically is more likely to be purchased by men than by women than by men. Okay? Okay. So having said that, imagine I now say, okay, look, I ran this ad and people on this side of the room buy more than people on that side of the room. That's why I think the ad is working. And you come back to me and say, I'm not sure about this, because couldn't it be that on this side of the room there's a higher proportion of women than on that side of the room, and women like the product better, so maybe it's due to the fact that more people on this side of like jewelry than on that side of the room. And then I would cut back to you and I would say, that can't be the case, because I randomized you into these two sides of the room, there are statistically not more women sitting on that side of the room than this side of the room. The proportion should be more or less the same. Does that make sense? Okay, so now you come back to say, okay, maybe it turns out that, say, Republicans wear more jewelry than Democrats. I'm making this up, okay? It's not a reference to Trump, I promise. Okay, so, and now you say, well, couldn't it be that there are more Republicans on this side of the room than this side of the room? And I would go back to you and I say, no, they can't be, because the randomization that I did ensures that there's the same proportion of Republicans, Democrats on both sides of the room. So that can't be the reason either, so I'm going to claim again it's because of the ad. And then to sort of bring it home, now imagine that there is an unobservable trait. I don't know what it, I can't measure it. Not only is it unobservable, but I don't even know what that trait might be. It is an inconceivable, unobservable trait, okay? Which happens to be correlated with liking jewelry more, yeah? And you say, well, couldn't it be that this side of the room has that trait? And my answer would be, no, it can't, because the same randomization that ensured that they have the proportion of men and women and the same proportion of Republicans and Democrats on both sides of the room will also ensure that I have the same proportion of that unobservable trait in both sides of the room as well. And this is true for every trait you can come up with, okay? So randomization, from a data science perspective, is as close as you can get to magic. I'm serious, it is incredible. If you can randomize, you have to care about nothing else, because everything that might mess up your analysis is taken care of, okay? It's incredibly powerful. This is why this is the gold standard of measurement in the world. Okay, so having said that, what you can do is you can look at these two groups, and while they're not identical, they're what's called probabilistically equivalent, which is the fancy speak for saying there shouldn't really be anything different on average between the two sides of the room. Fair enough? Okay, so that is the recognized best solution to this problem, and this is how ideally I would like to measure advertising. Yeah, everybody okay? Okay, so now remember this quote? Measuring the online sales impact of an online ad campaign is straightforward. We determine who has viewed the ad, then compare online purchases made by those who have and those who have not seen it. We okay? So how does this compare to what I just described? And let me just pull the picture up for you. This is essentially the measurement picture. I run an ad campaign. I don't run it as a randomized controlled trial. We'll talk about that later. But what I do is I say to, say, Facebook, or Google or somebody, please target women 18 to 49. Now, among those women 18 to 49, for a variety of reasons, not everybody's gonna see the ad. So I'm gonna pick women who saw the ad, and I'm gonna compare them to women who didn't see the ad, and I'm going to just look at the difference in purchase rates. What do you think of that compared to this gold standard of a randomized controlled trial? Is this a randomized controlled trial? What's different about this, if there is anything? That's a very good point. So you're not looking at the compositional characteristic. I mean, would you? So the core idea in a randomized controlled trial is that those two groups, except for the fact that they were exposed to an ad, would be identical, right? What do you think? If I give Google Facebook a bunch of money, and I said target women 18 to 49, and it turns out to be that 30% of the women who I wanted to target saw my ad, and I compare those 30% against the remaining 70%, do you think that the women who saw the ad and the women who didn't see the ad were the same kind of women? Can you come up with one reason why they may not be? Exactly. They may be influenced by different things, and I'll now sort of tell you the big issue, which is, that's exactly right. And do you think Facebook knows that or doesn't know that? Oh, yes, they do, yeah? And as a result of that, what Facebook is going to try and do is they're going to try and start going after women in terms of exposing them who I think have a higher propensity to buy jewelry. Got it? And so now you run into this problem because suddenly the women who see the ads are actually women who are predisposed to wanting jewelry. And so when you compare them with the women who didn't see the ad, who are less disposed to seeing jewelry, now suddenly you have this big supposed lift, but you don't know whether that's driven by the ad or because of the fact that these women were predisposed to jewelry in the first place. You get it? That's the basic situation. Okay, so I want to give you a sense today of how bad this problem actually is in practice. Okay, and so the question is, so you remember the premise here is to say, the premise really was that people thought that digital advertising was going to solve the ad measurement problem. They were saying, it has to solve it because I now know everything about everybody who saw the ad, I know everybody who purchased, which is all true, and the question is that enough? Yeah, is great data enough? Did you have a question? Yes.
How do you know it wasn't something to do with time, and maybe there's a group of women who are working more hours and
you know what? Also could be the case. All of those things are gonna mess us up, and I'll give you a little bit, like a little taxonomy of all the things that can go wrong, but that's one of them as well. You're totally right. Are we okay? Does it make all sense so far? Okay. So, in other words, you know, to be a little bit more technical, you know, I said, does great data solve the advertising measurement problem, or does great data eliminate the need for RCTs? And there's a really bigger point here, and the really bigger point that I want you to remember at the end is the digital media space is not unique at the moment. It's the one that's, we've seen this for advertising for a while, but you have to understand that virtually all of the things that Mohan Sawhney showed you produce data, right? These connected devices, all of this stuff. There's a naive belief out there, which I will try to debunk today, that the mere fact that we're collecting so much data about people means it's really easy to learn about what people do and how things work, et cetera. And that's what I'm going to question. All right, so let me now show you the issue. So it turns out that this method here that I showed you, namely, you take something where you compare group exposed to unexposed. In the industry, it's called an observational method. An observational stands in contrast to a randomized controlled trial. Okay? So basically, the idea of observational means you didn't design the experiment, but things fell out the way they did, and you observed them. This is what this is, right? So if I didn't control who saw the ad and who didn't see the ad, but people essentially, for whatever mechanism happened, saw ads and didn't see ads, I just observe what happened. It's called an observational method, okay? All right. So it turns out that in the industry, many people say that they, with great data, observational methods are good enough. Okay, so this is straight out of the Internet Advertising Bureau, which is kind of the industry association who deals with things like this, will literally write in that report that most people in the industry believe this is good enough, what I just showed you. Okay, let's see whether that's true. Okay, so what we did at Kellogg is we teamed up with Facebook to answer this question. And so what happened at Facebook is a really interesting, this is you know the expression, the political economy of something means kind of, you gotta understand the set of incentive system that's make people work the way they do. So it turns out that when, for a slightly complicated reason, when people do a terrible job at measuring, Google looks better than Facebook. And Google is Facebook's 800-pound sort of gorilla competitor. So what Facebook decided is that they were going to introduce as a business strategy really world-class measurement. Okay? And the way they did it is by implementing for their advertisers the ability of running randomized controlled trials. So if you are an advertiser that spends, you know, above some minimum amount of money, Facebook will for free for you run a randomized controlled trial. So for me as a researcher, this was awesome because I now have a benchmark. And so what we did is this. We took 15 large-scale RCTs, randomized controlled trials, that Facebook ran with advertisers, and we were allowed to pick them. So I picked those RCTs, and my co-author as well. And we picked them to have a few criteria. We picked them to be really large, so we had between 2 and 150 million users in every experiment, over 2 billion ad exposures. One of the things that's really nice about Facebook is that they require everybody to log in when you use them. So sometimes, you remember I told you about this cookie-based measurement? One of the big problems in cookie-based measurements is what happens if you have two browsers or two computers? Sometimes it's hard to link people. Facebook doesn't have this problem because everybody has to log in, okay? And we looked at these 15 studies, all of which had a real purchase outcome, like people actually bought. So they put their dollars behind something, okay? So this is like, this is sort of, it's a beautiful data set. And what we then tried to do, and I'll show you this in a second, is we essentially we now knew what the truth was because people had run this true experiment. And then we pretended like we hadn't actually run an experiment. And we said, okay, if we throw away that control group that is run as part of an experiment, how well could we re-engineer what the truth was, but without an experiment? That's what we were doing. That's the core of what I'm talking about today. Okay? So in other words, I said, okay, if I had been an advertiser and I hadn't run a true experiment, then using the best state-of-the-art methods that exist in the industry and in academia, how close can I get to the truth without actually running an experiment? That was the purpose. So let me show you what we found. Okay, so let me pick a study. This is study 4 out of 15, okay? I can't tell you who it is, obviously. We had 25.5 million users, 30% were in a control group, 70% in a test group. We are going to measure an actual purchase outcome, which is called having one of those little pictures that basically ends up showing you that somebody reached the checkout page, the checkout confirmation page, so we know they actually purchased. Okay, the study ran for 17 days last year. Okay, so the first thing that we did is we measured how well the advertising worked in part of the experiment. So the way the experiment works is essentially this. You have a test group who are people I'm targeting, women 18 to 49. I have a control group that are also women 18 to 49, but who I'm not targeting. They're never seeing an ad from me. That's my control group. So this is that side of the room, and this is this side of the room. Now, remember, on Facebook, I can't guarantee you saw an ad, okay? All I can do is I can say, I would like to show you an ad, but then whether you actually see the ad depends on whether you're logging in that day or, you know, how far down you scroll your newsfeed or things like that, okay? So it turns out in our particular study, 25% of the people we're targeting actually saw the ad, and 75% of people didn't see the ad in the test group. So these are the three things I observed. So first task is I'm going to now measure how well advertising works. So what I do is this. I pick everybody who saw the ad, and it turns out that among those who saw the ad, 0.104 of them purchased. These rates are always really small in digital advertising. Don't get discouraged by that. You can still make a lot of money with it, okay? Okay, and then what we asked is, okay, If we take people who look just like them, but who didn't see the ad, what was for those people, how likely were they to buy? And the answer is 0.059, okay? And so what we can now do is basically calculate the lift and say, okay, so this tells me what somebody would have done who saw the ad had they not seen the ad. That's my other world. And so the difference between this purchase probability and this purchase probability, that is the causal effect of the ad. Does that make sense? So this is, this number, 73%, I'm going to declare to be the truth. Because honestly, there's no better way in the world to measure this than that. This is as gold standard as you get. Okay? So this particular, by the way, not every ad Facebook campaign works. I'm allowed to tell you that. Some of them didn't have effects. This particular campaign had a lift of 73%. Okay, so now let's pretend I'm an advertiser and I don't have a control group. So we're going to literally kill that control group. Gone. And so I'm now going to try to replicate this measurement that we talked about early on. Okay? And so the first thing that we're going to do is just compare, just as I said beforehand, what happens when you look at the probability that somebody buys here versus here. Okay? Let's do it. Isn't that something? 416%. The truth is 73%. So, I mean, I don't have to tell you that if you're running a business and somebody comes back to you and says, the lift is 416% and it was 73, that maybe you would think that's a different number. Yeah? So, in other words, the naive measurement suggests that the advertising works ridiculously well. The correct measurement makes it still look good, but it is not ridiculously good. Okay? So, that's what you get. Okay. So, now you wonder, I think a few of you said this, which is that people are going to be different. So let's see if we can find that, okay? So I'm going to show you now a graph that for every demographic of those two groups shows you how it differs. Okay, here it is. So it turns out, this is a little confusing, this graph, but basically it says, so this is the average of a variable, and this is the unexposed and exposed people. So what this basically says is that people who are exposed on average are younger, less age, people who are unexposed on average are older, okay? This says that people who are exposed on average are much more likely to be female or less likely to be male. People who are unexposed are less likely to be. So imagine this were a jewelry product. What we've just basically shown is these are women, these are men. Are you terribly surprised about the fact we're not getting the right measurement? We're no longer comparing apples to apples. And why? Because Facebook knows exactly who's going to buy jewelry. Okay, that's sort of the idea. Okay, so you get the idea. You get massive discrepancy. So for example, this one is a huge one. People, this is Facebook web. So this means that people who bought, who were exposed to the ad, are much more likely to use Facebook on the web and much more likely to use it on mobile. Okay? So the point is, these are very different groups of people. And so when I'm now looking at what's the likelihood that one versus the other group bought, a lot of this is going to be explained by difference between people and not the actual effect of the ad. Okay, cool. So essentially, here is why these things happen. There are basically three big factors. Factor number one, this is what people call activity bias. Okay, so here goes. Dina, you're my designated person to pick on today. I'm going to say, you didn't see the ad because you were trekking in Nepal. Okay, you have an exciting life, clearly. So you were trekking in Nepal, and so as a result, when the campaign ran, you were just out of the country. So
Yosemite, not Nepal.
That's right, Yosemite, not Nepal. So you were just out of the country, and so on the one hand, you didn't actually see the ad, that's fine. But now you're in that unexposed group. Okay, so my question now is, in order to be a good control group, if you're in the unexposed group, it needs to be true that your baseline probability of buying jewelry is about the same than the people who happen to still be in the United States. So if you're tracking in Nepal, are you doing a lot of online purchases? No. Exactly. So do you see now the problem, which is, the unexposed group is people who are trekking in Nepal, and so they don't use Facebook. But they are also different in other ways, because they just don't buy jewelry because they're trekking in Nepal, okay? And you know, even if, of course, you were trekking in Nepal and you had online access, I'm not sure jewelry would be on your mind right then when you're trying to survive the ice crevasse up Mount Everest. Exactly. Okay. So this is the basic issue. There are other issues, which is every ad is served in response to an ad auction. So in other words, you have many people bidding for a person in real time. There's an auction that goes on, which basically sells the spot on your Facebook page to the highest bidder. Okay, so every ad you see placed on you has a full-scale auction running in milliseconds behind it. And the result of what gets shown to you comes from that auction. And so imagine now you have somebody who wants women who are 18 to 49, but who among that set wants people who have identified themselves, say, on Facebook as being married. Now, if that person is willing to bid more for married women 18 to 49, they will have siphoned off all those ads. And so the reason you got unexposed is because all the married people 8 to 49 were showing a different ad. And so now, again, it makes people differ, okay? So that's the second one. And the last one is, and this is actually my favorite, which is, so the way Facebook does this is Facebook tells you how they want, how you want, you can tell Facebook how you want to pay them. You can say, I want to pay you depending on how many ads you showed people. Or you can say, I want to pay you depending on how many people clicked on an ad. Or you can say, I want to pay you depending on how many people bought the product. You can choose as an advertiser. Let's say that you decide to pay Facebook by clicks. Okay? Good. So we target the ad women 18 to 49 on day one. At the end of day one, Facebook looks at this and says, well, among women 18 to 49 who are targeted today, who are actually clicking? So it turns out maybe it's women 18 to 25. So what do you think Facebook does the next day? They now go after women 18 to 25. So you can already see again that the group of women who get exposed and those who get unexposed start looking very different from each other. Yeah, so these are all, I mean, okay. From a data science point of view, this is a nightmare, okay? I mean, like I see this and my heart sinks because I gotta figure out how can I do measurement in this environment? It's very hard. Okay, so it turns out, of course, that the people in the industry actually know this. So they know that people who are exposed or unexposed will be different. And so what they suggest is the following strategy. They say, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to take everybody who sees an ad who is exposed, and now what we're going to do is we're going to find a subset of unexposed people who look just like them, who just happened not to see the ad. Okay, so imagine that all of these are, imagine my target group was 18 to 49, and everybody who saw the ad was 18 to 25. Well, the company then says, oh, no problem, I'll just take the subset of the 18 to 49 who happen to be also 18 to 25. And now I can do, again, an apples-to-apples comparison. That's the idea. And you do this not just with one variable, but you do this with 100 variables, 1,000 variables. Okay, and so what we set out to do is to basically answer the question, how does that work? So here's the idea. The idea is you take everybody who's exposed, and now among the unexposed, you find users who look similar to the exposed user according to everything I know about them. Got it? That's the method that's used. Good. It's kind of a clever idea. This is called matching, by the way. It's a particular data science thing. And so in addition to that, what we then did is we picked the state-of-the-art methods that exist in industry and in academia, which happen to be these four. I'm not even gonna like bother reading to you, but trust me that they were good. And then the last thing is they did is we picked, this is now where it gets really fun, is Facebook has really good data, okay? So we used, in like the most basic model, age, gender, how many friends you have, your relationship status, what phone you use, where you live, etc. Then we added as another test, that plus everything US Census can throw at you. As another test, we use all of that and we measured whether, so we don't know whether you're tracking in Nepal right now, but we know whether you were tracking in Nepal last week. So we use that as well as information to make sure that we don't, by mistake, pick people who were tracking in Nepal in the control group, okay? And then the next thing we do is, Facebook has this product which they use to find people for advertisers. So what they do is that imagine that you have an advertiser who says, these are like my 10,000 best customers. Can you find me people who are just like them on Facebook? And so what you do is you send them 10,000 email addresses, Facebook, and Facebook looks at those email addresses, matches them to the user base, and then what they do is they say, we have this big machine learning algorithm that finds people who are as close as possible to those 10,000 people. Okay? Among the entire universe of Facebook users that are not the 10,000, we'll find you another set of 1 million who look just like them. We use that algorithm. Okay? This is a massive scale, kind of artificial intelligence machine learning algorithm, and we threw that in as data to be able to do the matching. Okay? Okay, so let me show you the results. So the story is not depressing yet, okay? So remember, this is the totally naive benchmark, exposed, unexposed, 416%. The truth is 73. All right, this is the different methods and variables. So what you basically see is each method has a different color, and then as you progress from left to right, you add more and more information to be able to do the match. And in this particular case, you notice that the best methods, which is this one, together with the best data, actually gets you to the randomized control trial. You see that? Okay, so our original method did terribly, but if you are kind of clever and you use a lot of data, which incidentally, most people actually don't have data this good, okay, but fair enough. Here, we are lucky and we get this. All right, but now I'm gonna depress you. So we just pick another study of the 15 we have. I'm picking a random other study. This is what it looks like here. The true effect, 2.4%. The measurement, 1,657%. Throwing everything at it that we have. Okay. All right, so let's pick another one. So far, at least everything seems to be north of the true effect. Except here, where if we add variables, like half of the measurements are like way below how well the thing did. This measurement says that the advertising is driving sales away. Yeah? Are you starting to get slightly depressed? Okay, so I'm gonna now give you, I'm not a visualization expert, but I tried to summarize everything we had in one picture, okay? I hope your head doesn't explode at this point. So red is too high, blue is too low, and white is on target. Are you ready? Yeah? A lot of red, a little bit of blue, and an occasional white, okay? This is not business standard, how do you call this? I want to make decisions that are more reliable than this in life. Yeah, fair enough? It's crazy. You had a question?
I think that's looking, you know, taking the old paradigm and putting it in the current paradigm. Mm-hmm. When, as a woman, I would say, you need to use your intuition. You can't be on numbers like you used to. You can't be logical, you know, factual deduction.
So I'm going to push a little bit back against this, which is that what I'm going to say is. So what I'm going to basically say is that the problem is actually we're in a hybrid state. So I have zero problem with intuition, with decisions being made by intuition. In fact, an enormous amount of decisions have to be made by intuitions because there are no numbers to speak to them. The thing I really hate is, however, what a lot of people do, which is they use their intuition to come up with what they want to do, then they find the numbers that seem to support what they wanted to do in the first place. Right, but this happens everywhere all the time, right? So this is extremely common for people. Or what happens in this particular case is that people so fundamentally don't understand the data science behind advertising measurement that they end up thinking that what they're doing is all scientific and all correct, and it's completely wrong. That's not good either. So I'm completely with you if you want to stick up and say, I'm just not going to measure. And I'm going to do this by intuition because either I can't measure or because I think this is good enough. I have no problem with that. But I don't want anybody to pretend like they're measuring and then they're doing a really bad job. That's sort of my beef. Does that make sense? Okay. Yes?
I'm not saying that you don't know more than you did when you started, but it seems to me along the lines that she's talking about, mm-hmm. you started
as though what's happening is two events, and it's not two events, exposed, not exposed, it's a process.
Yes.
I don't see an ad, I go to the store, I don't like the product, it's too expensive.
Yeah.
I'm gonna buy it 3 months from now after I save, and again, it's like what I said before, you're still in a correlational world where you haven't captured all those indeterminate variables, and I think it's stymied by a lot of the big data folks say, oh, but we have so much data, we overwhelm that disadvantage, and I don't know whether I can believe that.
Thank you. I think I'm going to finish now. She's said my parting words. So, no, I mean it, which is the core problem is there is a naive view. Let me just actually give you my last slide, okay? So basically, great data is not a substitute for good data science, okay? That's the first thing. And now comes the really sobering part, and I know this for a fact because I have done I've done a lot of work with many companies on this. The average digital marketing manager in a large corporation does not know this. Okay? They do not know this, and their chief marketing officer doesn't know it either. The only thing they know is that it's sort of not entirely working right. They don't quite know why it's not working right, and they don't quite believe the measurements. But everybody that is on their that they have on their payroll, from the agencies to the measurement companies, all tell them they've got it covered, and they don't have it covered. Okay, so my parting word is this: beware. Measurement can create the illusion of insight. Measurement creates the illusion of insight, which I think, Hope, is essentially a restatement of what you said, which is it is what is the world we're in right now is a world in which we're having more and more and more and more and more data created. People think that the fact that there's more and more data created means that you can do a better and better and better job at finding out what happens. It does not. The fundamental problem about data analysis is that you need data that is not opportunistic, in other words, it happened to be there when you got it, but one that you design. An experiment is designed data. It's data whose collection you controlled, you manipulated so that you understand where it is coming from. If you don't know where your data is coming from, you can't do a really good job at figuring out what's going on. And so the thing I struggle with every day is that at every level, from the CEO down to entry-level people, people today need a working knowledge of data science. This is no longer a skill that you can give to a specialist, because there's so much data coming in management that you need to be able to see things like this and start asking questions about this. And once you have that working knowledge of data science, you end up being able to develop intuitions for when things aren't quite right and you can ask the right questions. So, you know, it's sort of funny that Paul and I are sitting here because this is sort of the tack we have around executive education at Kellogg today, where we're basically telling people, look, it doesn't matter what level you're on, but you've got to shore up in this knowledge that you'd so far thought you could leave to a specialist, but you really can't leave it to a specialist anymore, or you'll run into these kinds of problems. Yes.
I think you did a remarkable job. I think I'm very impressed. A question.
Yeah.
I often clean off my clothes.
Yeah.
Will people still know where I am?
No. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things why it was for us wonderful to get this data is that Facebook is like the only person who doesn't have this problem, because you can't even log on without identifying yourself. So one of the big things they sell to advertisers is essentially that they always know who it is, whereas other people don't know. Now, there has been a huge amount of engineering effort produced in essentially finding out, being able to do, when somebody deletes the cookie, it's kind of reconstructed as fast as possible that it was you, based on other things you did. So people have developed algorithms for, imagine you use Google Chrome and Firefox and Safari on your computer, for being able to understand that the three cookies are all you. But it's very tough to do, and in particular, the whole mobile world doesn't have that cookie paradigm. So it's very hard to figure out who gets things, seen things on mobile. This is one of the big advantages that Facebook has and other companies have that have services that are so compelling that they can where you're happy to identify yourself. Incidentally, Google, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but you know how Google gives you all these goodies that are all meant for you to log in. Like the fact that on Google Maps, you can use Google Maps, but if you log into Google, then you can just say home, and then it'll pop your address up, right? So that is not altruistic. That is so that you have an incentive to be logged on, so they can identify who you are, so the search business, the advertising business works better.
From your insider view,
yeah.
The world of these natural
organizations affect our lives, which ones do you think are doing the best job of adjusting? Yeah. So, let me just repeat the question. So Shirley said, out of these big organizations that are shaping the world, who are the ones who are doing the best job adjusting? You know, it's funny, I hadn't thought about this way, because those are the ones who are sort of creating all the trouble for the others, right? So in some sense, although actually, let me step back for a second. So you see situations where they have been adjusting over time, right? I mean, you could argue that the difference between Yahoo and Google is that Yahoo didn't adjust and Google did, yeah? Or you could argue that a lot of the things that Facebook has done has been precisely to ensure themselves that they get the next generation. So for example, they bought Instagram. And part of the reason was that more and more people are now doing their social sharing on Instagram. They bought WhatsApp, which was seemed like on the surface a crazy acquisition. They spent $19 billion on a company who's famous for promising consumers they will never advertise. Right, I mean, that's a, you're like, how does that work, right? And so I think that these companies are very actively paranoid about getting disrupted in a way like few others are, despite the fact that they look to be on the top. So I would say they probably do a really good job on average. Or like Uber, who is like investing in driverless cars, right? Things like that, yeah. Yes, please. No, that was a technical problem that was unrelated to this. What you're talking about was video viewing. So basically what happened is that they had made a mistake somewhere technically about how long people saw videos. And so the trick is that you report back to advertisers essentially whether somebody started watching a video ad and then whether they abandoned it after some time. And they had somehow gotten that wrong, and so they said that they had overreported how many people. So you're only allowed to count a video ad if it plays a certain amount of time by like advertiser norms, and they hadn't gotten that wrong. That is, it's completely independent of this. It was an embarrassment for them, but it has nothing to do with this. No. I mean, look, I don't know if you've asked yourself, why is Google working with us, right? Google is working with us is because they implemented this fantastic advertising testing platform, which I can tell you works really well, and I'm not getting paid by them. And it turns out that when they implemented it, they thought this was going to be a competitive advantage for them, because on Facebook you could, at no cost, do good testing, and on other platforms you couldn't. Until recently, you couldn't do this on Google, for example. Now you can do it under certain circumstances. And so what they did is they saw that's going to be our key differentiator. They went to clients and said, look, we have this great advertising testing platform. And the clients went, it's all right, no worries. We're fine as we are. And Facebook like, what? Why are you fine? And so this is when they started realizing that their clients simply didn't understand how bad their traditional measurement was. I mean, they have like a marketing science group at Facebook, which is they're very smart people. So they knew exactly about these problems. And so then we visited them a few, like 2 years ago, and we did I organized a trip for faculty to just sort of see what's going on in Silicon Valley around analytics. So we visited them, and I just did my usual, I have like this canned half-hour presentation on how we at Kellogg think about analytics. And so they listened to that, and they realized that we had thought a lot about how to communicate these data science concepts to managers. And they said, would you help us write a white paper where we can convince our advertisers that they really should do randomized controlled trials with us, what they call a lift test. And initially I said, okay, and I thought it would kind of be a nice thing for Kellogg to have something co-authored with Facebook, makes us look current. And then when we started working with them, what then happened is I said, boy, when we write this story up, it would sure be lovely if I could actually show that one of these experiments leads to different answers than what the advertisers have done so far. And then they said, okay, and now that's how they gave us all this data. And now we have this sort of long-run collaboration with them. And they are using, so we created, so you might look this up actually at Kellogg, we have like a 20-minute podcast, like a Planet Money podcast that describes what I'm doing today. We wrote 2 white papers for industry people. We've written an academic paper. And Facebook did like a video shoot of us, like talking heads talking about this problem. So the idea for them is they want the advertisers, they think it's in the best interest if the advertisers get good measurement. And so they want the advertisers to do it. And they're fighting a lot of entrenched, this is how we've usually done it in business. And they are also fighting a lot of data science ignorance in the business. And so they hope that we could help them somehow communicate that better. That's how it came about. Yes.
I understand on the advertising provision. What I find it interesting, I just went through my Facebook. And what I find interesting about that is they are always advertising to me a product that I don't have a relationship with, or a competitive product to a similar product, but never building that relationship. And I guess my question is, you know, looking at branding in today's marketplace and disruption as it relates to companies and the other keeping evolving and how much money branding costs me, and you cannot support the actual ad spend or prove it.
Right.
How are these companies, what methods have come up to create relationships? Because I trust the company that I trust, and I have a relationship with that company, so I'm never going to push that buy button or that ad.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, right, so it's really, and I don't think you mean it, this is really not a question about Facebook, it's a question of, right, because they don't control obviously which ads are shown. This is the result of what people are willing to bid. So I think that, you know, there's still a lot of traditional branding going on. A lot of these relationship building activities have moved in the online space, right? So I think the best examples of companies who are doing things like this is, do you know the Monster High series from, yeah? So what's, do you guys know this, Monster High? So Monster High is a doll, a series of dolls by Mattel. And the idea is that they are the kids of famous monsters. So it's Frankenstein's son or daughter and Dracula's, And so they all go to this high school together. And so it's a series of dolls. Hey, I'm sure at some point Barbie would look just as absurd to people as this. And so what they then do is they've basically decided that if you wanted to create a relationship, they have to sort of derive like an identity around these. And so part of the product has become a series of videos and episodes. You might observe this with Legos. If you have kids or grandkids who are into Legos, you notice that they're like gaga about going to these little online episodes where their little characters now do stuff. And so I think that's how a lot of the engagement is happening. And for that, of course, the online medium is really perfect. I would think that Facebook at least partially works for that as well. So I don't quite know why you have the history that you have, but I'm just gonna plead the fifth here. I'm not sure. Yeah. All right.
Thank you, Florian. Florian, I just want to point out that the chart that you've produced that is half red, I think scientifically proves the old adage that half of advertising is wasted. We just don't know what half. Lunch is served. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
We both have a class we want to present.
Well, new friends, thinking fast and slow. My people believe weird things. We know what we don't know.
Yeah, where is it?
Well, thinking fast and slow.
No, where is the class?
No, we want you to do it.
Do a class. Oh.
I thought you said you were going
no,
to
no,
a class.
No, no, we have neuroscience.
Yeah.
I have neuroscience.
The brain.